Hello and welcome to the Victorian Gas Lamp, the podcast shining a warm light on the 19th century and most notably throughout the reign of Her Majesty Queen Victoria. Episode 53, Never a Gentleman. If I was to say to you, give me your top five list of what comes to mind when you think of the Victorian era and 19th century Britain, I'm sure I'd get a wide variety of answers depending on your personal interest. Queen Victoria is probably going to be on your list, and infamously, so is Jack the Ripper. Thinking more, you might say someone who you have a personal interest in, be it the incredible Dr. Garrett Anderson, or my choice for greatest name ever, Kingdom Isambard Brunel. Maybe you'd add Charles Dickens or Jane Austen. From there, you could add our modern ideas of Christmas, or the fact that Ms. Austen's books are still making for great cinema and miniseries 100 years after their writing. Keep going, I want five. Maybe you're of a medical bent and would add diseases such as cholera or tuberculosis, or those of us loving writing literary works like Frankenstein or Dracula. But if you were more media based, you might be influenced to add, Heath, I'm filling out my top five with those crazy inventions they always seem to come up with. After all, in so many movies and even books these days, we have men and women in the Victorian era coming up with all sorts of fascinating machines and tools. Often they're the weapon to beat the bad guy, but it could be the exotic airship that they travel on to their final destination. This last aspect is what I do think some of you might add. I mean, there has even been the creation of an entire genre devoted to it. We all know it today as steampunk. But this episode isn't about steampunk. I'll save that for another time. Sorry to disappoint. But why is it called steampunk? Well, dear listener, that's what I'm here for. When you read that someone walks into a well-lit room, what is the last thing on your mind? What is lighting it? And when you read or watch something in the steampunk genre, I think we often think in the same way. Because in my top five, it's that one thing. Steam. For all the inventiveness of the Victorian era, it really was the first time that humans exploited and utilised a power source that was external to physical strength. We had human physical power, as well as animals such as horses or oxen or the quadruped of your choice, but having some sort of machine that could do the same was the dream of mankind for, literally, millennia. As far back as 200 BC, there is the writing of Hero of Alexandria, yes, that was apparently his name, reporting of a steam-powered engine called the aelopile. This was a simple device of a ball filled with water that, when heated, would cause the two built-in bent tubes to cause the ball to spin. From there, humans played with this concept. Using fluids or gases, inventors tried to find a way to harness the energy of the world around them. But to give you an idea of how difficult it was to crack the code and get the knowledge of how to use a material to create power, from 200 BC it took until 1712 for someone to create an actual engine. Englishman Thomas Newcomen and his assistant John Kelly finally created a viable option. By pressurizing, you guessed it, steam, the two men created an engine that was used to power a pump. Inefficient, yes, but viable, also yes. Hundreds of these engines were used to pump the water out of coal mines, because if you know anything about digging, you know at some point you're going to get water seeping into your hole. Especially if you're deep down in the earth trying to get the coal out and make it through the day, and avoid death by asphyxiation, tunnel collapse, or an utterly complete lack of workplace safety. Let's face it, the last thing you need to worry about is being drowned hundreds of feet below the earth's surface. I've just mentioned that it was an Englishman that created the first viable steam engine, But we all know where the next man who improved this came from. Scotland. I've said it before, and long-time listeners are well aware of my fascination with what must have been in the water north of Hadrian's Wall, because those Scots are crazy amazing at inventing pretty much everything. In the late 18th century, a Scot by the name of James Watt was working as an instrument maker at the University of Glasgow. Now, James became fascinated with steam engines, so much so that he redesigned the original, added some bits, and that made it more efficient and became a legend. How good was his invention? Well, let's put it this way. He's the guy that created the concept of horsepower as a measurement, and today a unit of power is named for him, the watt. He did this in 1776, but nothing else was happening in the world at that time, so we can keep moving forward. Big hello to all in the rebellious colonies that have just screamed at their phones listening to this. Now, James Watt, in conjunction with his business partner Matthew Boulton, had also created gauges, regulators, and valves that made controlling steam power that much more efficient. His work influenced a generation of engineers fascinated with the idea of using a created power source. And now, in our century of choice, it's in 1802 that Richard Trevithick created a high-pressure engine, and then the first steam-powered locomotive. For the record, he wasn't a Scot, but came from Cornwall. Big shout out to all the listeners in Cornwall. My great-grandmother came from there, and I still have the recipe for her pasties. And for the record, they're amazing. I said before that the 1800s were the time that men exploited steam during this era, because it really was the time that it came to be a power choice that could be genuinely used in industry. Up until now, the use of steam had been limited by both the invention and those who thought it could be more useful as a motor source than people or horsepower. Trevithick's locomotive made its first trip on February 21, 1804. Carrying 10 tons of iron, 5 wagons and 70 men, it went a distance of 9 miles successfully. In 4 hours and 5 minutes. Okay, so you can stop laughing, because even though I am too, but think about it, they hauled all that equipment plus 70 people and had never been done before. It's an incredibly long time, but it is a start. To give this some perspective, the first flight by the Wright brothers was in 1903. It's something most of us are casually aware of from a trivia point of view, but did you know that that first successful flight, the one which defined the future of aviation, was only 12 seconds long. It was as short a trip as the first train travel was long, and it was only 44 years later in 1947 that the legendary West Virginian Chuck Yeager broke the sound barrier. And back in the early 1800s, well, steam power was just getting started. George Stephenson and his son Robert built the first real practical locomotive in 1814. Used to haul coal, it was called a travelling engine, but it set the standard for what was to come. And people were noticing this, particularly investors and speculators in the future. The Stephensons weren't the only people making engines, and those with money saw what was coming. Thus was created the Stockton and Darlington Railway, aka S&DR. It was the first public railway, using trains to not only transport goods, but people. The S&DR started out moving coal, because thanks to capitalism, financial assets and profits were always going to be more valuable than people. But it came to be realised that trains could also carry people, for money, no less. As the train lines were extended, so too was the ability of people to travel easily and comfortably. Why struggle with the discomfort of a rocking, jolting wagon when you could sit comfortably in a train that trundled across the landscape, getting you to your destination? And their first public train that S&DR ran with? Well, it was known as Active initially, but has gone down in history as Locomotion Number 1. And for all the train fans out there, well, you guessed it, Locomotion Number 1 was built by Robert Stephenson and Company, also known to us as Dad, George and Son. But they didn't rest on their laurels, the father and son Stephensons continued working on their designs. Brilliant men, and it was in 1829, only 25 years after Trevithick's first train, that Stephensons went down in history for creating the legendary Rocket. Rocket was the name of their locomotive. Also my cat, but he was named for the Guardians of the Galaxy raccoon, so all he gets is the occasional Instagram post, which I know many of you are aware. But back to the Stephensons. Their locomotive Rocket won a competition amongst other engineers with pulling a load at an average speed of 13 miles an hour. Again, we might say not quick, nor I guess was the unloaded speed of 29 miles an hour, but they were the best, and their design and the improvements that followed in their work began to make the public realise that this was really a viable option in terms of the future of transport. And while there had been public transport via rail before now, this competition brought rail and steam to the forefront of the public consciousness. As I said at the beginning of the episode, steam is intrinsic in the, well, cultural understanding of the Victorian era. It represented an incredible technical progression among society. But who were George and Robert Stephenson? Well, I'm glad you asked, because, well, it's segue time. George was born in 1781 in Northumberland, near Newcastle upon Tyne. Both of George's parents could neither read nor write. His father was a fireman and had no money for school. This was before the ragged schools, so that meant no education for George. He too was illiterate and was 17 and working when he realised what an education could do. So out of his own wage, he paid to study at night. He learnt to read and write as well as arithmetic. He continued working and married Frances in 1802. He was now a brakesman, a man who controlled the winding gear in a mine. Additionally, he made shoes and repaired clocks for extra money. Robert was born in 1803, and then in 1805 they had a daughter, named Frances after her mother. But this was the 1800s, so inevitably, and sadly, baby Frances passed at 3 weeks old. Topping this off was that his wife, Frances, she died of consumption the following year. With only Robert alive, George left him with a neighbouring woman and went to Scotland looking for work. He soon returned, as he had also now to care for his own father, who had been blinded in a mining accident. Back in his local area, his sister moved in with him to care for Robert while George worked at the mine. He continued eking out a living until 1811, when the pumping engine at the mine began failing. George, with his self-paid education and a mind that was, well, brilliant to say the least, offered to repair and improve it. So successful was his work, he was promoted and became responsible for the maintenance and repairing of the steam engines used at the mine. Talk about a self-made man making good. I don't think it takes too much imagination to recognise how dangerous it was to be working in mines, particularly when occupational health and safety was something that they hadn't even heard of. One of the big issues with being down in the pit was called fire damp. This was methane gases that were prevalent in coal mines. And given that your lighting was flame-based, well, I'm sure you can see where the problem might be. So George began designing a lamp that could be used deep underground without the risk of killing everyone. By 1815, through trial and error, which is mildly terrifying, he had created a safety lamp that could be used in the pit. And so confident in his design, George took it down into the mine where fire damp was leaking into the air and showed it would work. This was an incredible invention, one that could save countless lives and allow work to continue. It also again showed just how smart he was. But down in Cornwall, a place known for mining as much as George's home, a man named Humphrey Davy had been working on a design too. I'm not going to take anything away from Davy. He was another brilliant man, and he was a member of the Royal Society, a community devoted to scientific progression. He used electricity to be the first to isolate potassium, sodium, calcium, strontium, barium, magnesium, and boron, and he experimented with nitrous oxide and basically had society realize that laughing gas could be used as an anesthetic. So, really smart. Also, super well connected and knew the right words and people. So when, a month after George had gone down into the mine and proved that his invention worked, Davy presented his personal design to the Royal Society, well, it was Davy that got the £2,000 reward, and George was accused of simply copying the idea. The locals in the Northumberland region were having none of this. A local group of supporters proved he had worked separately and created the Geordie lamp, as it was known. Geordie is a nickname for someone that comes from the Newcastle region, by the way. George was awarded £1,000, but this always rankled Davy and his own supporters, who could not believe that a man with such little education could create such a lamp. So the Davy lamp was used everywhere else in England, but the Geordie lamp was used throughout the northeast. This gave George a lifelong distrust of so-called scientific experts. But also, he recognised that his own broad Northumberland accent meant that he was automatically discriminated against. Accordingly, he made sure that Robert went to a private school where he was taught English in such a way as to gain an accent that was acceptable to the upper echelons of society. So who actually made the better lamp? I mean, that's the question we're all asking. Author Lionel Rolt wrote about it in his book George and Robert Stevenson. The Davy lamp gave more light, certainly, but at a mine in Barnsley where both types were used, a massive rush of fire damp caused the tops of the Davy lamps to become red hot. Nothing happened this time, but it was known that such heated metal could in itself cause a mine explosion. And the lamps created by the man who learnt to read and write at 18? They just went out. I think I know which one I'd be carrying. Aside from this, and with all his knowledge of how steam engines work, it was around this time that George turned his hand to locomotives. Was he successful? Well, I think you know the answer to that already, but let's just say you don't get called the father of railways for nothing. But how did his son Robert get there too? Well, as I have already mentioned, Robert's father wanted to make sure his son had a solid education. Starting at the Percy Street Academy in Newcastle, he also joined the Newcastle Literary and Philosophical Society. This society is actually the largest independent library outside London. Known as the Lit and Phil, I have to say I'm itching to visit there. But for Robert, it was a place he could borrow as many books as he could, which both he and his father would devour. Robert finished school in 1819 and undertook an apprenticeship to a mining engineer. In 1821, well, we saw his father George surveying the land that would be used for a new railway line. That year also saw son Robert being down a coal mine when there was an explosion. Even with the safety lamps, mining work was still incredibly dangerous. He was also beginning to show signs of consumption, that dreaded disease we all know of so well by now. He was still in his apprenticeship, however, but the man he had apprenticed to must have realised that Robert's time was done in the mines. Accordingly, he released Robert from his apprenticeship, which allowed him to go to work assisting his father surveying. And Robert must have done some pretty impressive work. One of his father's colleagues was Robert Bald. Bald was an engineer too. I might cover him in more detail another time, because when you're now known as the father of mining engineering in Scotland, you have had quite the life. And it was that Robert Bald that spoke to George Stevenson and convinced him that Robert should attend university. George agreed to this, but wanted Robert to do a partial degree over just 1 year rather than a full one. with the money he was now earning, George could have sent Robert to somewhere like Cambridge, but the father did not want his son to just become a gentleman and that he should work for a living. Thus, Robert attended classes in 1822 and 23 at Edinburgh University. The surveying continued, and after more changes and parliamentary processes, everyone came to the agreement of an early suggestion of George's, that steam locomotives should be used on the lines. His suggestion was backed by the success he had had on smaller railways using steam-powered locomotives. But this was a much larger project, and this is where George ties into the S&DR Railway Company, because what he was planning on doing is connecting a number of mines in the northeast of England. This ultimately became incredibly successful for decades and continued expanding when it was realised the savings in time and money that could be earned in moving coal to ports quickly and efficiently. In addition to having set up the railway lines, in 1823 the company known as Robert Stephenson & Co. was formed and had contracts made to make the locomotives. And if you're wondering why they were making railway lines if they weren't going to use locomotives, that's an excellent question, dear listener. In many places, a fixed steam engine would be used with ropes that would pull rail carts along a line. These were used all over the country and were the normal use of steam power. But having a moving engine, the locomotive, was something that was gradually being seen as a viable option, largely due to successful projects like those that George was working on, and thanks to the locomotives that were being created. British mining interests in South America also saw the value in being able to move product, and the Stephensons got the contract to build engines for railways being created there too. The Stephensons continued improving on their engine designs, as well as the drive train and wheels. For example, they only ran direct power to two wheels rather than more because driven wrought iron wheels wore down faster. Thus, when replacing wheels, only two needed to be changed rather than all of them. Additionally, piping water that was needed for the steam through the boiler meant it was already heating up before it got where it was needed to create the steam. In 1829, at what was known as the Rainhill Trials, his designs proved their worth. A new line was being built between Manchester and Liverpool, and the L&MR, as it was known, was soliciting tenders for locomotives. Of the five different designs competing, the Stephensons was the only one to complete. This was the legendary Rocket, and it impressed everyone and set the standard for decades to come. And if you go to the Locomotion Museum in Shildon, well, as of last year, it's right there for you to be amazed by. And rail expanded from there. Now seen as the preferred option for moving goods, they were also starting to move people. The Stockton and Darlington line that I mentioned before had wagons that people would ride in, so this is regarded as the first public railway in the world. However, it was in 1830, on the Manchester to Liverpool line, that modern train transport, as we know of it today, that is, with carriages that were designed specifically to carry people, first occurred. Steam engines also benefited from European politics. British industrial interests took advantage of the changing landscape. In 1830, Belgium became independent from the Netherlands, but Belgium did a huge amount of trade with what is today Germany, making use of the waterways. But these waterways were Dutch controlled and presented an economic risk in transport, so a railway line, inspired by the new Liverpool to Manchester line, was built. And more trains were made and became part of the social fabric. But I'm not here to cover Europe because that would be someone else's podcast. But back in the United Kingdom, railways continued being established across the land. This really began to escalate in the 1840s. Driven by economics, obviously, investors saw the opportunity to make money and poured money into these new rail lines. The locomotives required supplies on the travels as the rails became longer. Towns benefited from becoming train stops, and this created more business opportunities for locals, not only in supplying the trains, but also becoming destinations for visiting, by the steadily increasing volume of people that took advantage of being able to sit back and enjoy a ride on the new technology. And people really did love train travel. With billions spent on rail lines, the people continued to travel by rail. By 1870, 423 million travelled on the now 16,000 miles of track. By the end of the century, trains were carrying over 1,100 million passengers a year. In the last year of the century, lavatories were added to the carriages. Also, through the use of dynamos attached to the wheels, electricity was created and dimly lit carriages with only windows for light were now electrically lit. The average speed of these trains was around 20 miles an hour. Sure, it's not quick by today's standards, but it was for the time, and travelling by a carriage would have been more expensive as well as being far slower. Braking was still needed to be applied to each carriage individually, so greater speeds would have brought other problems, like, you know, stopping. And additionally, using iron and not steel to make the rails meant that higher speeds would have caused more wear and tear. But most importantly, time and space were being changed in the decades of the Victorian era. People could travel easily and visit places. Family and friends was now a much shorter trip, giving you more time at your destination. And naturally, train travel presented opportunities for crime. In the early days, carriages had no connecting doors and people were robbed if found alone in one. Additionally, with the crowds now being found at train stations, pickpockets would target these places. And for the tragic trivia, the first murder on a train occurred from Fenchurch to Hackney in North London in 1864. But with the advent of lighting and police adapting their practices, trains became a much safer place to be. And there was another side effect to all this travel. People met people that they never would have otherwise encountered. News, information, opinions, and ideas were being spread faster and further than might otherwise have been. Goods were being moved so much faster. Perishable foods like meats and dairy could be delivered to further and further destinations in the knowledge that they would still be fresh upon arrival. People were experiencing foods that they had never tried before. The benefits of locomotives were seen all over the world. More and more countries established railway lines, but it really became a defining symbol of the technological and progressive nature of the British Isles. This was the first time that people were travelling by a manner not reliant on animals or their own physical labour. I've mentioned before about the fact that while we see this era through the modern media as gritty but clean, well-dressed people encounter people in clean rags rather than the filthy cotton they would have been in, and the streets are never covered in animal and human waste, steam engines were loud and noisy and made a lot of smoke. But by removing that biological element, they're automatically perceived as being clean. To me, it's for this reason that so much of the Victorian era literature written then and now makes use of steam travel. It represents that idealistic view of an incredible era. As an endnote, George Stephenson continued to make locomotives all his life. He was kept incredibly busy, having more work than he could attend to. And while others moved into the trade, George was always seen as a man who made quality engines. A rich man, he supported wives and families of those that had been injured or died while employed by his company. He was a keen gardener and built hothouses. George had a rivalry with the head gardener at nearby Chatsworth House, the home of the Duke of Devonshire. That head gardener was someone that long-time listeners may be familiar with. He was Joseph Paxton, and Joseph being the man that took his own hothouse designs and created the Crystal Palace for the Great Exposition. George died at his home in 1848, aged 67. His son Robert had left the business in 1847 and became a conservative politician in the town of Whitby, a place I've been to twice and I highly recommend the fish and chips. He actually became one of the commissioners of the Great Exposition, so no doubt he worked with Joseph Paxton as well. He spent much of his time in London, but his health was suffering and he had chronic kidney problems. he was constantly annoyed by people trying to impress him with promotional ideas or new inventions. In 1850, he commissioned a 100-ton yacht called the Titania, which gave him welcome relief from harassment. His joining of the Royal Yacht Squadron made him the first member not from a privileged background. He was awarded as a Knight of the Legion of Honour by the Emperor of France in 1855 and became a predicate of the Institution of Civil Engineers in 1856. Now, throughout his life, he was good friends with the aforementioned legendary Isambard Kingdom Brunel, who I covered back in episode 21. In 1859, he travelled to Norway. He'd been there a number of times and was instrumental in creating their railways. At this time, he was there to receive the Knight Grand Cross of the Order of St. Olaf, but he fell ill at the banquet. Travelling home to England, he landed on the 14th of September, and it was on the 15th that his friend Brunel actually died from a stroke. And less than a month later, on October 12th, Robert Stevenson died. It made the news all over the kingdom, especially as he was the second titan of the new industrial age to die within a month. The Queen gave permission for his funeral procession to pass through Hyde Park, normally only reserved for royalty. And one last little story. For all his acceptance of overseas honours and his personal wealth, Robert remained a man of his workers. His will donated funds to various institutions as well as family members. In 1850, at a celebratory dinner to open the Royal Border Bridge across the Tweed in Berwick, Robert was sitting in pride of place next to Her Majesty Queen Victoria. He was offered a knighthood and declined. Maintaining his father's legacy, he would never be a gentleman. He was a working man after all. And here endeth the episode. You can find me at victoriangaslamp.com. My contact details are on there as well. And you can follow me on Twitter at @VicGaslamp. And more importantly, on Instagram, where I post historical facts and trivia as well as photos related to the episodes. I am at Victorian Gaslamp, all one word, there as well. Thanks for listening and keep a lookout for new episodes. And as always, I'll see you next time under the gas lamp.